Hello, and welcome to There's Hope with Homeopathy. This monthly show airs the third Friday of each month and focuses on classical homeopathic treatment, how it can benefit your entire family, and especially how it can be a curative therapy in the treatment of autism. My name's Amy Lansky, and I'm broadcasting from Portola Valley, California, in the San Francisco Bay Area. And today's show is supposed to air on February 16th, 2007. Okay, everybody. Well, you know, I always begin the show with some current events, and obviously the current event of this week is Valentine's Day, which, as I'm recording this, is tomorrow, but when you listen to this, if you listen to it live, will be 2 days ago. I don't know about you, but for some reason this year, Valentine's Day feels a bit more meaningful to me. I don't know what it is. Usually, to me, it's just a Hallmark holiday, but I just feel more of a connection, feel more loving and appreciative of my family these days. You know, life is so accelerated and chaotic, it feels. And in our homes, with the ones we love, we can find stillness, a kind of stillness in our life that I think modern life is really lacking in that connection with others. And one reason I mention this is that I feel, this is just an intuitive feeling I have, that this is especially what our autistic children need, that calmness. You know, the world has become such a whirlwind, even more so. If we reflect back to our youth, I mean, I'm 51, it certainly felt like times were very different, even back in the 60s, which were a kind of a crazy time. But things are moving so fast, I feel that autistic children really need a sort of place of stillness, a place of calm to find their way back to us, their connection back to us. And that this kind of connection is so important to their recovery. I often think back on one of the earliest autism books I read, the Sunrise book by the Kaufmans, about how they would work with their son in the bathroom. You know, they'd close it off in this very small, quiet space and work with their son. And I think part of it is that it created just this very still, isolated environment that was helpful for him to finally have the courage to make the connection with the parents and make the way back. And I think it's even harder for the parents in this community to achieve this than most people, because they themselves are in such a frenzy and panic, understandably so, trying to, you know, search and grasp at ways to help their kids. And so that's why I'm saying to you that this finding this place of stillness, perhaps through meditative practices, this connection, this kind of quiet connection, is very important to the recovery of your child. Of course, this show is about using homeopathy, but I do believe that the parents that can reach their children in this very calm, supportive way are finding greater success if there is that sense of peace within the family. And actually, you know, I've talked to many practitioners and people I interview on the show, and many of them say how the family dynamic is an important key to the kids who have success versus those who don't have as much success. And so I hope that will be the subject of a future show, talking a little bit about sort of the spiritual dimension of autism and how to bring our children back to us. Well, it's also, let me see, it's February, 2 months from now, is also the National Center for Homeopathy's annual conference. Actually, now it is the annual National Joint Homeopathic Conference. It's not just the National Center's conference anymore. It really is the national conference for all of homeopathy and all the practitioner organizations. So they changed the name last year to the Joint Annual Homeopathic Conference. So this year it's going to be in April in Denver, Colorado. The conference runs from April 13th through 17th, but it's particularly the weekend of the 14th and 15th. And so for those of you, especially near Denver, you really might look into attending the national conference, which is both for the public and for practitioners. And to find out more, just go to nationalcenterforhomeopathy.org. Before I start today's show, too, just want to remind all of you that this show really is in many ways based on my book, Impossible Cure, The Promise of Homeopathy. And if you go to the ImpossibleCure.com website, you'll find lots of resources and information. There's a page about autism treatment with referrals to practitioners. There's the archives of this radio show, which I really encourage those of you who are tuning in for the first time to listen to the archives of the show, because really this show is a little bit like a short course on homeopathy, so you'll understand what I'm talking about much better if you catch up on the show. So on the right side of the homepage, you'll see links to the archives. There's the Cure Stories database, which check out some stories that have been contributed by homeopathic patients, and please contribute your own. And there's, of course, lots of information about how to order my book, either singly or in bulk. And feel free also to email me anytime. You can email me through Autism One. That's A. Lansky, L-A-N-S-K-Y, at autismone.org, or just through my book website, Lansky at impossiblecure.com. So, and, you know, feel free to ask questions. I answer all the emails I get, at least within a week. And you know, feel free to suggest different topics for this show as well. Well, today's show is focusing on different methodologies of homeopathy. I know many of you go to classical homeopaths. That's what I talk about, classical homeopathy, on this show. But some classical homeopaths incorporate other methods into their practice, and some practitioners aren't classical practitioners and use other methods of treatment that they also call homeopathy. So I think it's important for all of us to understand what homeopathy is, what's within the scope of classical homeopathy, what is not considered homeopathy by classical practitioners, and just to know what these methodologies are. And within my book, the subject of today's show, and this will probably be part one because I think there's enough material here for two shows, the subject is found in second half of chapter 6 of my book. So today I'm going to begin by talking about, first I'm actually going to talk about the genus epidemicus. This is classical homeopathic treatment, that method, and then talk about isopathy, which a lot of people have questions about, what's called tautopathy, which is, many people, I'll use isopathy for this too, try to explain the difference, the use of specifics, the use of organ remedies. Next time I will get into my, at least, understanding of what sequential homeopathy is, and then other methods that some people confuse with homeopathy, but are related to homeopathy, in particular the use of machines to pick homeopathic remedies, and etc. We'll just begin then, and we'll see how far we get. Next, the March show, I'm not sure if I'll do the continuation of this show or I'll have an interview with a practitioner in March. It depends on the schedule of the homeopath I'm trying to get for that show. So this show will either continue in March or in April. So we'll see how it goes. Okay, so let's begin by just recapping what is classical homeopathy, you know, just very briefly. And it's really very simple in concept. It is treatment that is individualized, and it may be either constitutional or chronic. It's individualized treatment, so that means each person is analyzed and given a single remedy, one remedy that matches their symptoms. And the same methodology can be used either for prescribing for chronic problems, and people often call that constitutional prescribing. So this is the remedy that fits that person overall in their usual chronic state of health. Or it can, the same method is used for acute, what we call acute prescribing, which is when that person is like sick with a cold or the flu, something like that. So this classical method of treatment is based on what we call the totality of symptoms. Both the physical and the emotional and the mental symptoms are gathered together, and one single remedy is selected that matches that person overall. So that's classical prescribing, and the same methods used if you're for any disease that you have. How can we diverge from this particular method? Well, there's many ways. One is what's used when there's an epidemic, and this is still a classical method. It's called finding the genus epidemicus for the epidemic, which means the set of remedies that match the epidemic. And this is completely classical, except that instead of individualizing the treatment to one person, several people who are suffering from the epidemic are treated as a single case. In particular, let's say a homeopath is treating several people who have the same epidemic, let's say a flu epidemic, and they notice that all of these people are having these various symptoms. They gather up the symptoms of this epidemic from several people's cases, and they analyze them as one case. And that case will yield a set of remedies that tend to cover most of the symptoms of the epidemic, and that set is called the genus epidemicus. Those remedies can be used for treating this epidemic. And let me get into that. I'll get into that in a bit more. So that is one way that we can diverge from the strictly classical paradigm, which is focused simply on an individual. But how else can we diverge from classical prescribing? One is to base your use of remedies on some theory about disease instead of on the symptoms that the person in front of you is actually exhibiting. So it's based on sort of ideas about diseases instead of what symptoms the person actually has who's sitting before you. That's another way you can diverge. Another way you might diverge from classical prescribing is that you give remedies based on, let's say, past experiences with a particular disease, certain remedies that have worked, but they also don't necessarily match this person who's sitting in front of you. So that's another kind of theory, in a way, about this person that you're having that isn't based on their symptoms, but rather on some theory you have. Of course, another way to diverge is to use multiple remedies instead of a single remedy. And many practitioners who diverge from classical prescribing do this. They combine several remedies together. And another way that you might diverge from classical prescribing is to do your analysis not based on any symptoms at all, but on the use, for example, of these machines that are supposed to measure your energy field and select a remedy for you. And as I describe in my book, this really is questionable whether this is homeopathy at all. So, so let's begin then with talking, I already started, about the genus epidemicus method. And this really is classical homeopathy. And in fact, Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy, his very first paper about homeopathy was about this method, the method of treating epidemics. He wrote his first paper in 1801, and it was called Cure and Prevention of Scarlet Fever. And he talked about his treatment of a scarlet fever epidemic with the remedy belladonna, which is made from the same plant that's used, for example, for dilating the eyes, because it causes an increase in the size of the pupil. Still used to this day for that purpose by allopathic doctors. Anyway, he found that belladonna matched the symptoms of the scarlet fever epidemic, and he used it both to treat the people suffering from the epidemic and also as a prophylactic to prevent people from getting the epidemic. And so this genus epidemicus method is useful both for treatment and for prophylaxis instead of, for example, vaccination. So one important thing to note, though, about this method, the genus epidemicus method, is that although, let's say, these three or four remedies that are found for a particular flu epidemic are useful for that epidemic, they may not be useful for the next epidemic, even of the same disease that comes along. Every epidemic is really different. We know this with the flu, by the way. We know that the flu seems different every year. Some flus make you cough and feel very tired. Other flus make you feel very achy. And in homeopathy, those would be treated with different remedies because they have very different symptom pictures. So in the genus epidemicus method, you usually do not give remedies to a person or your patients until the epidemic is actually in progress and you can see what the symptoms actually are. You come up with the remedies that are useful for it and you give those remedies out as appropriate according to the symptoms of each patient that comes to you. So what do you do then if the epidemic's not happening? What do you do to do instead of taking, for example, the flu shot if you don't want to get the flu that year? Well, one method that most classical homeopaths will simply say to you is simply ongoing classical homeopathic treatment, chronic treatment, your constitutional remedy should prevent you from getting sick or really lower your susceptibility to the flu and help you recover faster, even if you get it. So you'll just be in a better state of health, so you'll be less likely to get the flu, and even if you get it, you'll recover faster. So they basically, most classical homeopaths will not recommend taking anything prophylactically, just waiting and seeing what happens. Of course, once the flu is in progress and you, let's say, for example, a family member gets it, you might want to take one of the genus epidemicus remedies as a prophylactic. That is possible. But most people are uncomfortable with that, and they want some other method of prophylaxis. And that is when we start straying from the classical methods. And so this brings us now to the subject of isopathy. This method of treatment is very similar to homeopathy, and so it's usually lumped in with homeopathic treatment. And most homeopaths will use methods of isopathy on occasion. So what is isopathy? Once again, we are using single remedies, and the remedy is made from, for example, the very same substance that you think you're trying to avoid. So if you're trying to prevent a disease or recover from a disease, then you would take a remedy made from that disease substance. Or let's say you are suffering from allergies, then you would take a remedy that is made from that allergen that you're allergic to. For example, if you're allergic to ragweed, then you take a remedy made from ragweed to prevent the allergies. An assumption is made here because we do not know, for example, that pathogen, let's say that disease substance, let's say spittle from the flu, we do not know that really is causing the flu, and we do not know if that allergen is really the cause of your underlying susceptibility to that allergen. It's really, in a way, a theory. But so in this sense, we do not really know that substance is really causing your disease. Certainly in allergies, if you are allergic to, let's say, cats, it's not really cats that is causing your allergy. You are allergic to cats for some other reason. That's a disease susceptibility that you have. Cats don't cause allergies for everybody. They only cause allergies for you. That means you have some chronic problem that is causing you to be allergic to cats. So to take, let's say, cat dander in as a homeopathic remedy in potency, you know, potentized form, well, it's possible that might help with your cat allergies, but it is very unlikely to cure you of your cat allergies so that you don't have cat allergies anymore. This subject's kind of near and dear to me because I have always been very allergic to cats, extremely allergic to cats. And I've been seeing a homeopath for many years, and only recently I took a new remedy starting this fall, and only recently suddenly my cat allergies seemed to be gone. This remedy had nothing to do with cats. It was just my particular remedy. Actually made from a metal, and suddenly I seem to not be allergic to cats anymore. So in other words, my susceptibility, my underlying constitutional disease that caused me to be allergic to cats has now been treated. Anyway, nevertheless, the use of isopathy has been very important, and it can be useful. And so especially people will tend to use it as a sort of quote-unquote homeopathic vaccination against a disease. So, for example, you can make a remedy from any disease substance. You can make a remedy is made each year called influenzinum, which is made from byproduct of the flu, or pertussinum, made from discharge from whooping cough, or morbillinum, which is made from the measles, some measles byproduct, anthracyanum, which is made from anthrax, variolinum, made from a smallpox pustule. There's remedies made from all these diseases. And by the way, remedies that are made from diseases, there's a general name for them. They're called nosodes, N-O-S-O-D-E. And these nosodes are very important remedies and helpful in treating lots of different things, especially in autism. Nosodes are very useful, especially the nosodes made from cancer, from tuberculosis, from gonorrhea. These are very important remedies. And I know it sounds incredibly yucky, but the remedies made, just remember that these remedies do not even have a molecule of the substance in them. They're highly dilute, so it's more like the energy of this underlying disease state. And it makes sense, for example, that these might be useful to our kids, especially since they've been injected with so many different vaccines, and we know that might be the cause, in fact, of their autism. Anyway, it's also interesting to note that taking this kind of remedy has even been sanctioned legally at times in the past in the United States. For example, the remedy variolinum, which is the remedy made from smallpox, was legally allowed. In the early 1900s, there was legislation in Iowa, I believe, that said that instead of taking that early smallpox vaccine, people could take this homeopathic remedy instead as a method of prophylaxis. So that's very interesting. In fact, there's actually been studies done that show that this kind of method of prophylaxis actually does work. It may not work as well as taking the standard vaccine, and I do not advocate that, by the way, but it still does work. So this says quite a lot because, for one thing, these are benign remedies. These remedies aren't going to be sticking mercury into your bloodstream. And secondly, you can use this method of isopathy to treat any disease, even if you don't know what the disease is. So let's say some terrible epidemic's going around. Nobody knows what the hell it is. But if you can somehow, let's say, get some substance, you could create a remedy from this disease and give it to people and achieve some level of prophylaxis. So this is an amazing thing that could really help in national emergencies. In fact, I'm going to tell you about one study. One study on this is described in my book. Let's see. Let me find the page. Actually, this one is in chapter 7 of my book on the medical studies. It was a study done by Wayne Jonas on the use of a substance made from this, from a remedy made from the disease tularemia. And this was a lab study done on rats. This tularemia disease is completely lethal to rats. And by giving a nozode of this tularemia to these rats, first that was administered, and then they would give the rats a lethal dose of this disease, and they would see how long it took to kill the rats or if any of them survived from this disease after they'd been, quote-unquote, prophylactically treated for the disease with the remedies. And it turned out to be 22% successful in preventing the disease. So it wasn't as successful as being vaccinated, but it was 22% successful, better than nothing. And so if we could prevent some unknown epidemic with 22% success, that would be pretty good. Another study like this was even more successful. This was done in 1974 in South America. They've experimented a lot with this in South America. There was a meningitis vaccine going meningitis epidemic going around among kids, and they treated many thousands of kids with meningococcinum, which is a remedy made from the meningitis. Let me find that. That's on page 153 of the book. So as part of the trial, 18,640 children were given this meningococcinum 10C, which is the disease diluted 100 to the 10th. So it's not a really high dilution, but it's certainly beyond any point in which there'd be a molecule of the disease. And then 6,340 children did not receive the nozode. So out of the 18,000 kids that got the nozode, only 4 cases of meningitis developed. And out of the 6,000 children, 30 cases got it. So if you do the math, the untreated children had 25 times the chance of getting the meningitis than the homeopathically treated children. So this was an even better case of success. Homeopathic prophylaxis is also really popular in Europe for treating domestic animals. For example, it's used to control bovine mastitis and kennel cough prophylactically. So this just gives you an idea of the power of isopathy to prevent disease. Now, one thing I want to warn you, though, about taking, let's say, influenzinum, or using this method for treating disease, the use of these nozodes to treat the disease once you get it is in some cases considered ill-advised. In particular, in the literature of the past, when people were getting tuberculosis more, the use of the remedy tuberculinum, which is made from tuberculosis, was considered ill-advised once you had tuberculosis. So it's not always the best method for treating the disease once you have it. It's, in that case, would be better used as a preventative. And that in general, if you know the genus epidemicus for a disease, like say a flu epidemic, that will work much better to prevent the disease, and, or certainly to treat the disease once you get it, than these isopathic remedies. And then also, as I mentioned, that these nozodes are usually used for treatment of chronic disease, not for treatment of these epidemics, and that they are very important remedies for the treatment of chronic disease. Oh, okay, there's also been studies, I'm reading here, and this very, very highly successful studies in the uses of potentized allergens in the treatment of allergies. Like I said, this will help treat the allergies, but very rarely will it actually eliminate your proclivity to having the allergy. So, for example, you might have a season where you're not allergic to pollen or to dust mites or whatever it is you're treating with the isopathic remedy. But it may not eliminate your allergic proclivity itself. And if you want to achieve that, ongoing chronic homeopathic treatment is the best way to go. Now, of course, the response that most people have to this use of isopathy is to say, is this like vaccination? And maybe it is in principle, because the remedy somehow triggers a healing response of the vital force to the energy of the remedy. It sort of gets your body to know and respond to this, the energy of whatever this is, whatever disease or allergen this is. But it is very different from a vaccination in many, in a few important ways. And as you know, most homeopaths are really opposed to vaccination the way it's done now. The first thing is that the remedies, like I said, you're not getting the actual pathogen injected into your bloodstream. Of course, along with all these other toxic things like mercury that they stick in the vaccines. You are getting the energy of this, whatever it is, on this little sugar pellet that's put into your mouth. It's the energy of the disease, not the actual disease substance injected into your bloodstream. And the other important thing about this method of treatment is that the remedy is only given when it's warranted, when there's an actual epidemic looming, or when you actually have allergies. You don't just give it just because, you know, according to some protocol. Now, there are homeopaths out there. A noted homeopath, his name is Isaac Golden. He's a homeopath in Australia, who do use fixed protocols of doing this and treat kids this way. They'll give fixed protocols of giving various pathogens in isopathic remedies in potency, or they'll even give vaccines in potency, vaccines turned into remedies. Now, this is considered highly unconventional and would probably be considered dangerous by most homeopaths. I don't think he's gotten many adverse reactions, though, but I don't think he's treating, for example, autistic kids who are highly sensitive. In my view, giving protocols of lots of these isopathic remedies just as a sort of some kind of protocol is not well advised, and certainly not advised with autistic kids who are highly sensitive to begin with, because then you might have aggravations. So this is not what I, as a classical homeopath, would not recommend this. Only to use this method when you know there's some actual, case of possible disease coming your way, or when you actually really are allergic to something. Okay, well, I'm going to move on to one more. That's how far I'm going to get today. And that's the subject of tautopathy. And this is usually mixed up with isopathy. So people will use the term isopathy for tautopathy. But the use of tautopathy is really closer to classical homeopathy. And it's defined as follows. Let's say you know a person really has been poisoned by some substance. Let's say you know a child really has suffering from arsenic poisoning because they had arsenic, in their drinking water. This happened in India recently. In that case, you can give that substance, let's say arsenic, in homeopathic potency, the potentized form of that substance to help cure them. The reason why this is classical is because it actually meets the definition of homeopathy. If a substance can cause certain symptoms, it can cure those symptoms. So if you're suffering from arsenic poisoning, you really are suffering from symptoms that occur from arsenic poisoning, and therefore your body is calling for the remedy arsenic because it will also cure those symptoms. So this method, which is often mixed up with isopathy, but it's really tautopathy, is used to treat lots of things. Poisoning from various drugs like steroids, from mercury, thimerosal, from when we know that a child really has had a reaction to a vaccine, so you would give that vaccine in potency. Like I said, there was a whole study done in India about the use of this method for arsenic poisoning from arsenic in the drinking water. Was highly successful. There's an amazing story in my book on pages 240 to 241 about a man who was working in the orchards, and they used to spray arsenic in apple orchards to get rid of pests as a method of pest control, and he was suffering. He was dying from arsenic poisoning, and the homeopath gave him a very high potency dose of arsenic 10 mg, which is arsenic diluted 100 to the 100 to the 10,000, that's 1 followed by 20,000 zeros, that dilution. And the man proceeded to start sweating profusely, and the sweat coming out of his body, drying on his clothes, was like arsenic was appearing on the outside of his clothes as the sweat dried. So he was literally sweating arsenic out of his symptom. He was nearly dead, and he recovered completely and got the arsenic out of his system. Sometimes using this method of tautopathy requires a bit of sleuthing. This is the kind of case where we say the person has never been well since taking a certain drug or some situation. There's a story like this on page 154 to 155, and I think I'll read a little bit of that one. This was a case of a woman who came to see a homeopath, Ian Watson, in England, and she had problems. I'll at least paraphrase this story because it's a page or a whole page long. But it says, a woman in her 60s came to see me and told me that her gullet had shrunk. When she tried to swallow, food became lodged behind the sternum and caused a hot pain that went through to the back. The pain was relieved by regurgitating the food. On drinking, she often had spasmodic attacks of hiccups. She had frequent belching, a sensation of a lump in the throat that was not relieved by swallowing. About 8 years before, she had an internal investigation which caused lacerations to her gullet, which I assume is her esophagus, and they even punctured her right lung. Oh, thank you very much. And her lung collapsed, and she got pleurisy. So when this woman came in, he first treated her with things that helped from the result of this trauma of this operation, but she still had the problem with the pains on swallowing and stuff, and he tried various remedies. Then he started inquiring further, and he found what started this problem. So it turns out that 1 year at one point she was given some naproxen, which is a non-steroid anti-inflammatory drug, and as soon as she started taking it, she developed the awful burning in the esophagus that she was complaining from. So, and a week after, she stopped taking the drug, but ever since then, she had the difficulty swallowing, and she'd never been well since then. So at this point, he tried various constitutional methods of treating her unsuccessfully, and so he got this drug, naproxen, in the 30C potency. The pharmacies, not the ones in the drugstores, but the ones who make the remedies, will have various drugs that they've turned into remedies. And so he sent her 3 doses of this naproxen 30C potency, and the next day it says her husband called and said, "What the hell have you given my wife? She has never looked so ill since the Asian flu 30 years ago." Well, she was having, obviously, an aggravation from the remedy, which can be a good sign. And so the homeopath says, "I tried to sound confident that all would be well and to wait one more day. The next day, the woman rang me and proudly declared that she had just eaten toast without any problem for the first time in years. She had no further trouble at all for about 3 months. She could swallow anything. There was no pain, no regurgitation. Her wind disappeared. Her general health improved. Then she had a partial relapse after the sudden death of a friend." That's very interesting, too, because that can happen. You know, suddenly she's entered a new state. He treated the grief with a grief remedy, which is Ignatia, which took care of it. And then she was fine after that, and her problems never returned. So this is an interesting story because first he did the appropriate thing, which is try constitutional prescribing, but there was some block in there. This lady had some kind of layer of disease that had been caused by this iatrogenic poisoning. That's what we call it, poisoning from a drug. And so that needed to be treated. And so and that's what he did, and this problem was removed. So that's tautopathy, but often called isopathy. Well, that's all I have time for today. But next time I'm going to go on either in March or in April, and continue on with some other topics. These include what we call specifics, the use of specifics types of remedies, the use of organ remedies, the use of cell salt remedies, and then I'll start talking about methods like sequential therapy to treat. So that's about it. I want to encourage you all again to visit the ImpossibleCure.com website. I also encourage all of you to join a particular Yahoo group called Homeopathy for Special Needs Children. And it's an email list that is for parents and homeopaths who treat autistic children, and or not just autism, but other kinds of disabilities of that grouping. So ADD parents too, sensory integration problems, things like that. So you go to homeopathysnc.org to find out about that. And of course, one more time to encourage you to visit the National Center for Homeopathy website, which is nationalcenterforhomeopathy.org. So remember, there really is hope with homeopathy. See you next time.